It's Tuesday, June 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, the U.S. Senate finally approves a bill to renew a domestic surveillance program, but with new limits on the collection of Americans' phone records. Our Senate correspondent gives us an update. FIFA President Sepp Blatter agrees to resign under pressure from a corruption scandal. I'll have the latest reaction to that from Twitter. And U.S. President Barack Obama gets tougher with Beijing over its activities in the South China Sea. But is he exaggerating the perceived China threat?
What China is doing with its land reclamation activities, I would describe more as maybe low-intensity coercion at best.
Those stories and more on International Edition. The U.S. Congress has completed moves to end the government's massive collection of telephone call data to thwart terrorist attacks. The Senate voted 67-32 in favor of legislation already approved by the House, which will turn over the task of data collection to American telephone companies in 6 months. Tuesday's vote sends the bill directly to President Barack Obama for his signature. He has said he will quickly sign it into law. I spoke earlier to our Senate correspondent Michael Bowman and asked him what persuaded some of the bill's Senate opponents to finally say yes.
Michael, the 67-32 vote approving the bill by the Senate came about by a realization by many Republicans that it was this bill or nothing. In other words, without some bill, there would be no restarting of the bulk collection of Americans' telephone records. And there were many Republicans who opposed the bill on principle, who felt that these records should be kept by the National Security Agency so that they would have easy access to those records. But faced with the possibility of no records being kept at all by any entity, there were enough Republicans who grudgingly voted for the bill, joining with Democrats who are unified in their support for it, that the bill ultimately passed.
Is there any sense of what pressure these Republican senators who did grudgingly approve the bill, what pressure did they come under to get them to take this step today?
Michael, this was a vote that is somewhat rare on Capitol Hill in that there are an awful lot of votes where it's partisan lockstep, where all Democrats vote one way and all Republicans vote the other way. Today's vote was a vote of pure conscience. Individual senators were voting according to what they felt was ultimately best for the nation. And then you could tell from the floor debate that they took it very seriously, and they were really grappling with big concept issues having to do with national security and constitutional guarantees and civil liberties and Americans' right to privacy. And that is really, I would venture to say that down to a single member, senators weren't necessarily responding to specific pressures from their constituents, but rather to the internal battles of their own conscience.
Well, our Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman, thanks so much for that update.
Thank you.
Turning to the world of soccer, Sepp Blatter, president of the World Football Federation, FIFA, abruptly resigned Tuesday in the midst of an unfolding corruption scandal. Blatter had been reelected to a fifth term as president just 4 days earlier. He ordered an extraordinary Congress of the Football Federation to choose a new president and said he will retain his presidential powers until then. Election of a new FIFA president apparently will take months. Experts expect a vote could take place between December of this year and March of 2016. Well, let's look at what some of the tweets that are going out there on the Blatter resignation. The New York Times at NY Times, it has a tweet saying officials confirmed that Sepp Blatter was a focus of a U.S. federal corruption investigation. So perhaps an indication there of the pressures that Blatter was under to persuade him to make this step of resigning. The Economist, which has a Twitter handle at The Economist, said, "So it turns out that Sepp Blatter's shamelessness does have its limits after all." Another view comes from The Guardian newspaper. It sent out a tweet saying, Sepp Blatter finally lets go of FIFA as the FBI noose tightens. The FBI, of course, is the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Another tweet from Time magazine, at Time. Time says, since he took over as FIFA president in 1998, corruption has tainted Blatter's reign. And that is a quote from its latest story. Topsy, an analytics website, says there have been 886,000 tweets mentioning Blatter in the past day, and that exceeds the more than 500,000 tweets that were posted last week when he won re-election. Well, this is VOA.
Trending on the web, it's action, reaction.
Get ready. Time to blow your mind with a few celebrity facts. We begin with James Franco. Before hitting the big time, he was flipping Big Macs at McDonald's. So when he countered with, would you like some fries with that? Was he just mastering his craft? Christopher Nolan does not have a cell phone. Apparently, he only needs a bat phone. The Queen of England does not have a passport. Why? Because all passports are given in the Queen's name, so she doesn't need one. I guess they just stamp her crown through customs. Here's something you never knew. The King of Rock and Roll hid things behind his crown. That's right, Elvis Presley was a natural blonde. Rumor has it that he used one tube of hair dye for the top of his head, 10 tubes for his sideburns.
We're using that greasy kid stuff, too. just like it.
For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Lisa Bora.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. In Burundi's capital, anti-government activists have returned to the streets to protest President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. Emily Eob was in the streets of Bujumbura when Burundian police confronted the protesters and filed this report.
Scenes of unrest resume on Tuesday morning in Burundi's capital city, Bujumbura. Police used tear gas and live bullets to disband groups of protesters in several neighborhoods of the city. The protesters opposed President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term in office. As soon as the clashes erupted, bystanders and street vendors quickly ran to find shelter behind gate doors, observing the scene from a distance. Still, some got tear gas canisters thrown in their backyard, among them Eric. He said the police has decided to attack the population. He said they threw these tear gas in his yard, where there are mamas and papas and children. In another neighborhood, tensions were also high. A car from the Red Cross made its way between the police and the protesters and took away several injured people, who said they were hit by live bullets from the police. Instead of protecting us, he says, the police kill us. The renewed violence comes after East African leaders gathered in Tanzania last weekend to discuss the crisis in Burundi. They urged the government to delay the elections planned this month, but the protesters say that the summit did not address what they asked for, that President Nkurunziza not seek a third term. Critics say a third term would violate the constitutional two-term limit, but supporters say it is allowed because he was elected by parliament, not voters, for his first five-year term in 2005. The spokesperson of the government told journalists on Sunday that the presidency is favorable to postponing the election, but has yet to make an official statement and give new dates. Parliamentary elections were originally meant to take place this Friday, and the presidential election 3 weeks later. Emily Yop for VOA News in Bujumbura.
U.S. President Obama has warned that Southeast Asia risks becoming less prosperous as countries in the region undertake land reclamation and assert sovereignty over parts of the disputed South China Sea. In a speech Monday, Mr. Obama singled out China for criticism, saying that while some of Beijing's claims may turn out to be legitimate, it should stop throwing elbows and pushing people out of the way in pursuit of its interests. VOA's Victor Beatty has that story.
Speaking to a gathering of young Southeast Asian leaders at the White House Monday, Mr. Obama said what has allowed the region to prosper in recent decades is relative peace and stability, including the freedom of navigation in the South China Sea.
All of that has been because there have been certain rules that everybody's followed. Freedom of navigation requires that people observe basic conduct about this far off your territory is your territory. After that, it's international waters. If there's a dispute, then there's international mechanisms to adjudicate that dispute. If you start losing that approach and suddenly conflicts arise and claims are made based on how big the country is or how powerful its navy is instead of based on law, then I think Asia will be less prosperous.
Mr. Obama says while the U.S. has no claim and is not a party to the regional dispute, it does, as a Pacific power, have a stake in seeing disagreements resolved peacefully, diplomatically, and in accordance with international standards. The president says land reclamation and aggressive actions by any party are counterproductive, adding that Washington will support those countries willing to work with the U.S. in establishing and enforcing norms and rules that will ensure future prosperity.
And the truth is that China is going to be successful. It's big. It's powerful. Its people are talented and they work hard. And it may be that some of their claims are legitimate. But they shouldn't try to establish that based on throwing elbows and pushing people out of the way. If, in fact, their claims are legitimate, people will recognize them.
China has indicated it has no intention of halting its construction efforts on disputed islands, saying it is in line with its sovereign integrity, and adding that if it backs off, U.S.-led forces will become emboldened and take tougher positions against Beijing. It says no country values regional peace and development more than China. And Kit Ponda, co-editor of the regional current affairs publication The Diplomat, says Mr. Obama's choice of words better described China's 2012 naval confrontation with the Philippines over Scarborough Shoal or last year's dispute with Vietnam over China's construction of an oil rig in the Spratly Islands.
What China is doing with its land reclamation activities, I would describe more as maybe low-intensity coercion at best. Contravening international law, threatening the freedom of navigation, all of these are terms that the United States has used in recent weeks, and I think that those are better descriptions of what we're seeing in the South China Sea.
He says the major concern observers have is that China is preparing to announce the establishment of an air defense identification zone, ADIZ, as it did in 2013 over the East China Sea. He says that could impede the freedom of navigation and overflights. China analyst Scott Harold of the RAND Corporation says creation of an ADIZ in the South China Sea could prove counterproductive for Beijing in the expected hostile reaction it would receive from its neighbors.
As we look back at the air defense identification zone that China established in the East China Sea a couple of years ago, as shocking and as inappropriate as that event was, it actually has not had much relevance for the way countries regard China's East China Sea claims. In fact, the U.S. immediately contested it. Japan also refuses to acknowledge it. It has not assisted China in helping to lay claim to the Senkakus or to force Japan to acknowledge the legitimacy of China's claims.
Harold says the South China Sea is a more widely shared body of water and more geostrategically important than the East China Sea, and that would result in creating enemies without achieving anything substantive. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo. This may put a bit of a dent in the ego of our male listeners, but did you know that certain female animals living in captivity, such as birds, reptiles, and sharks, have been known to reproduce without any help whatsoever from a male mate? Years ago, scientists found that the offspring produced without any male intervention were the result of an asexual reproductive process called parthenogenesis, or virgin birth. Until now, scientists weren't sure if this form of reproduction was possible with animals that lived in the wild. But now a team of researchers say they have found the first evidence that this form of asexual reproduction indeed does take place with vertebrate animals in the wild. The scientists say that their research shows that around 3% of a species of fish called sawfish living in an estuary in Florida were born as the result of the parthenogenesis form of reproduction. And that's your science in a minute.
This is VOA's International Edition. Have you ever wondered why Swiss cheese looks the way it does? Well, VOA's Ira Melman has, and he reached out to Daniel Wexler of the Swiss Department of Economic Affairs at the Institute of Food Sciences in Bern, Switzerland. He asked Wexler about the reason that Swiss cheese has diminishing or disappearing holes.
We have small microbubbles in these hay particles, and if you if these particles come into the milk, these microbubbles, they stay in the milk and they are still present in the cheese, and it's just like a chill starts to blow up a balloon. Then it's always very difficult at the beginning to blow up the balloon, and once it's opened, it's easier to push more air inside it. And it's more or less the same principle also in afformation in cheese. So if you have these micro bubbles in the cheese, then it's possible to have the formation of holes. And if the air are missing, then you have cheeses that are completely blind. They are lacking of this hole. For me, the appearance of such cheese is not very nice, so I prefer to have nice cheeses with holes inside it.
So how do you go about fixing the situation? They're not going to go back to having these particles in the milk, are they? You're going to plate, or are you going, or are you suggesting that that the farmers place such particles in the milk again?
I would say it's not the farmers, but of course on the level of the manufacturer, there is really a target conflict nowadays between hygiene and the lack of these particles. And so I would say it's really a good possibility to have a very hygiene milk, good milk quality, and despite of using very hygiene conditions, to have still a nice opening in the cheese by adding some particles. And if you look at the quantity, if you work with 10 tons of milk, you need about 50 milligram of hay dust. And so this is a very natural way of allowing the formation of holes in the cheese. And this is not an additive, just like an E number or something like that.
So how do you view the future of Swiss cheese?
They will be all the time the same nice quality as ever. So I don't worry about the quality of Swiss cheese. We have a really high quality of our products. And, of course, they are still made from raw milk. And therefore, the milk quality is one of the most important things you have to consider. And So I don't absolutely not worry that we will not manage to have high-quality cheese rolls in the future.
But will there be holes?
Of course.
And that was VOA's Ira Melman speaking to Daniel Wexler of the Swiss Department of Economic Affairs. Singer Nathan Sykes gained international fame with the boy band The Wanted. Last year, the band members decided to take a break. But as VOA's David Byrd tells us, Sykes has a new solo project, and the first single comes out this month.
Hi everyone, I'm David Byrd, and here's a look at what's happening in music. Last year, when the British boy band The Wanted announced that they were taking a break, singer Nathan Sykes was only 20 years old. But his passion for music didn't go away because he and his bandmates wanted a change. Sykes is launching his solo career with a new album, and the first single, Kiss Me Quick, comes out this month. The 22-year-old Gloucester, England native says that he could not imagine his life without music, so going solo was a natural next step.
I was 20 at the time when we decided it, and I was like, I'm far too young to stop doing what I love. And for anyone who's like, oh my God, he's left the band, he's like, well, what do you expect me to do with my life? Sit in a dark room for the next 10 years and wait for a phone call to say, oh, we're going to do another tour. It's like, what do you expect me to do? You know what I mean? So I was like, I love music so much, and I can't imagine my life without music. So I just went and made a solo record.
Sykes says that fans can look for his new album to be a departure from some of The Wanted's hits like Glad You Came or Chasing the Sun.
He's like soulful pop. And there's like a nice, healthy balance between fun, light-hearted, kind of flirty, upbeat, like, kind of horn-influenced tracks. And that kind of contrasts well with the deeper kind of, like soul of the album.
For the new album, Nathan Sykes worked with producers and songwriters Harmony Samuels, Babyface, and Diane Warren to craft his sound. Nathan Sykes says that even his former bandmates in The Wanted liked the new sound, though they weren't above giving him a little ribbing about it.
They were like, wow, this is, like, a lot better than I thought it would be. I was like, that's a backhanded compliment. But I was like, what, did you not think I was capable of that? They were like, no, if I'm honest. I was like, oh, great, cheers, guys. But, yeah, they're pleasantly surprised.
The full album is scheduled for release in the autumn in the UK and North America. And Nathan Sykes said he is always open to doing another album with The Wanted should his bandmates decide they want to.
Obviously, I'm so focused on this at the moment and excited about it. But of course, the door's always open to doing something in the future, maybe with the boys.
For VOA's International Edition, I'm David Byrd.
That is Nathan Sykes helping us close out today's International Edition. You can find us on voanews.com by clicking on the Programs tab at the top of the page, then scrolling down and clicking on the link to the International Edition program page. I'd like to express my thanks to Director Tracy Carter, and the engineer today was Carl Starling. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you'd like to find me on Twitter, my username is @Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC, Chief Executive Officer Dana Hyde and Deputy Vice President Fatima Sumar met with Mongolian leaders to discuss development of the country's new compact and impacts and sustainability from the country's first compact. The discussions focused on MCC's approach to reduce poverty through economic growth, the Mongolian government's leadership role in developing a second compact, and the constraints analysis, a key foundation of compact development. The MCC delegation also congratulated the Mongolian government on the 25th anniversary of its democratic transition and reaffirmed the strong relationship between the United States and Mongolia. Both Mongolia and the United States agreed that the anniversary marks an occasion for continued cooperation between the two countries, as well as MCC's commitment to helping Mongolia consolidate its democratic transition by supporting its economic development. Throughout their week-long visit to Mongolia, the delegation visited projects from the first compact, including the Salkit Wind Farms, a vocational school in Qair, peri-urban rangeland areas in Tuv Amag, the Qair-Sainshand Road, and Hospital No. 3. They met with local government officials in Gobisamber and Umnagobi Amags and a wide range of civil society representatives, including women leaders. The delegation concluded its visit with a visit to Ulaanbaatar's Gur district and meeting with the mayor. In December 2014, the MCC Board of Directors selected Mongolia for the development of a second compact. Currently, MCC and Mongolian officials are conducting an analysis of the country's economy and constraints to growth. The Millennium Challenge Corporation is proud to work with Mongolia to sustain the gains it has made towards economic empowerment for all the people of Mongolia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world. We present them in a way that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. Today we have a special program. Domestic violence is a serious problem in Bangladesh, especially for women and girls who live in poverty. A group of nonprofit organizations is working to bring change to thousands of the country's poor. Jill Robbins tells us more.
In Bangladesh, domestic violence is a serious problem for women and girls who live in poverty. These women and girls are beaten or attacked in the one place they should feel safe, their homes. It is difficult to change this situation because of deep-rooted customs. But a group of nonprofit organizations is working to bring change to thousands of the country's poor. In a slum area of Dhaka, 10 people sit in a narrow street between small homes. Women with colorful shawls on their heads sit next to four men. They listen as two health workers, both women, talk about birth control methods and diseases passed through sex. The health workers also show photographs of how the diseases affect the body.
The surprisingly open discussions are part of a program called Shoki. Its goals are to improve health and reduce domestic and sexual violence in 15 slums in Dhaka. Shoki is a project of several nonprofit organizations. It offers legal advice and health services. Women can find these services in small offices throughout 15 neighborhoods. The program also offers counseling services and community information meetings. At those gatherings, people can learn about subjects like conflict resolution and how to control anger. The people taking part in the Shoki program all volunteered to be change makers. They talk with small groups in their communities about ending violence against women. There are about 1,500 of these changemakers. They received training from about 45 professional community workers.
Rashida Begum is a 32-year-old tailor, making and repairing clothing for other people. She became a changemaker more than a year ago. Years ago, she said, her husband often hit her. But after attending Shoki's programs, her husband has not hit her in a year. Before, if anything happened in the home, he got very angry at me and would beat me. Now, he's working with this group and getting a lot of information that you shouldn't do this, she said. Another important step for Miss Begum was learning about her legal rights. She had her husband arrested after he illegally married a second wife. Later, he ended that marriage and returned to Miss Begum and her family.
In Bangladesh, violence against women is widespread, even in their own homes. Physical and emotional abuse by husbands is common among the poor. In urban slums, women and girls suffer from high rates of violence and poor sexual and reproductive health. Girls who marry early have even more problems. Bangladesh has the world's fourth highest rate of child marriage. Here, 65% of young women marry before the age of 18. Through Shoki, men and women are learning that abuse is unacceptable and illegal. In small group meetings, many women and girls are learning about their rights for the first time.
Sarah Hossein is head of Bangladesh Legal Services Trust, one of the organizers of Shoki. She says that providing information is very important to her work. It's not just telling them that you have a right not to be beaten, but where to go if this happens, what you can do, who will help you, she said. Three other nonprofit groups are involved with the program. Marie Stopes Bangladesh is a nonprofit organization that deals with women's reproductive health issues. The Bangladeshi Women's Health Coalition and We Can both work against domestic violence.
Shoki is similar to an earlier program in Dhaka called SAFE. Some of the same nonprofit groups directed that program from 2012 to 2013. Population Council, a U.S. nonprofit research center, and ICDDRB, a public health institute, looked at the results of SAFE. They studied more than 12,000 people in the program. They found that SAFE reduced violence against women and girls. When men were included in activities, there was even less violence. More people used birth control, and more victims of violence asked for help. Among teenage married girls, sexual and physical violence decreased.
People at the meetings say the sessions can make them feel stronger. One female changemaker said, "Public action is the best action. The police can't do it." Before, if something happened in the home next door, you ignored it. Now you can tell them you can't do that. Since the program started in 2013, it has directly given services and information to 10,000 people. It has reached tens of thousands more indirectly through media campaigns and street theater. Shoki aims to reach 500,000 people by 2018. Involving men in awareness sessions and as change makers led to a greater reduction in violence. That finding comes from surveys of the earlier program in Dhaka. Male change makers lead about one-third of the community groups.
On a hot spring day, another group of 20 slum residents sat on the floor of a school in a slum area of Dhaka called Mohammadpur. Amid the women were five men. They were starting their three-day training to become changemakers. Mahbub Alam is a 45-year-old night security guard. He attended the training during his off-duty hours. He explained why he volunteered to become a changemaker. "We think we live in an undignified way. We have an opportunity to change this," he said. It is not easy to stop violence against women and girls in Bangladesh, but Shoki is raising hopes that change can happen from the ground up. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to VOA,
The Voice of America, coming to you from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Here is Jonathan Evans.
Around the world, people are excited for the 2016 Summer Olympic Games. The host city for the events is Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The city is known as Cidade Maravilhosa, the marvelous city, because of its beautiful landscapes. But one body of water in Rio, Guanabara Bay, is not so marvelous. The bay is known for having very polluted waters. The area is filled with raw sewage and trash, from empty water bottles to household furniture floating in the waters. Guanabara Bay is also the location of the sailing events for the 2016 Olympic Games. Much of the sewage flowing into Guanabara Bay is untreated. City officials have said they would reduce the amount of raw sewage flowing into the bay by 80% before the 2016 Olympic Games begin. But officials noted recently that they are not likely to meet that goal. Recently, the Brazilian sailing and environmental organization Instituto Rumo Náutico refused an agreement to help clean the trash in Guanabara Bay. The Associated Press reported that the organization said the agreement presented institutional risks. The organization would have received $6.3 million to help remove waste from the competition areas. Workers would use what are called eco-boats to pick up floating trash. André Correa is the environmental secretary for the state of Rio de Janeiro. He released a statement saying he was disappointed with the decision by Instituto Rumo Náutico. The priority now is to create an emergency plan to clean up the area where the Olympic sailing events will be held, he said. Cleaning up Guanabara Bay has been a goal of government officials for many years. But little progress has been made. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent on cleanup projects going back more than 20 years. Few observers believe the situation will improve before the 2016 Olympic Games. Some famous sailors worry that competitors might become sick from the spray of the sewage-filled waters. They also worry about possible dangerous boat collisions with floating couches or refrigerators. Officials in Rio say that the Olympic event route will be safe. A test event is planned for August of this year. André Correa says that no effort will be spared and we'll join forces so that this year's test event takes place within the expected water quality levels as last year's did. But environmentalists say that the test event last year happened during high tide. Many of the pollutants and garbage were pushed out of the competition path. If the event takes place during low tide, they say, there may be dangerous consequences. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more agriculture, science, and environment stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
I want to say to you that for the next 4 years, there'll be a Democrat in the White House and you're looking at it.
Presidential elections are exciting events in American politics. Few elections for the White House have been as exciting as the one in 1948. And few have had such surprising results.
This is NBC Television.
We have obtained the results from the state of Ohio, which assures victory for President Truman and Senator Barkley. With Ohio's 25 electoral votes, President Truman and Senator Barkley will have a total of 266 votes in the Electoral College. This is the minimum figure necessary for victory.
Four candidates were nominated for president in the 1948 election. One was the man already in the White House, the candidate of the Democratic Party, President Harry S. Truman. Truman had been the party's vice presidential candidate with Franklin Roosevelt in 1944. When Roosevelt died a year later, Truman became president. He was the one who made the decision to drop atomic bombs on Japan to end World War II. But Truman did not do well during his first few months in office. He made several serious mistakes. He had trouble with the economy and organized labor. His party lost control of the Senate and the House of Representatives in the congressional elections of 1946. Most Americans had little faith in Truman's ability as a leader. They expected that he would lose the presidential election in 1948 if he chose to be a candidate. President Truman did choose to run. He took several strong steps to show his leadership in the months following the Democratic defeat in the congressional elections. Truman called on Congress to pass a number of laws to help black people. He took firm actions in his foreign policy toward the Soviet Union. These included the Marshall Plan and the Berlin Airlift, as we discussed in our last two programs. And he began to speak out with much more strength to the American people. Truman succeeded in winning the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. He chose Alban Barkley, a senator from Alabama, for vice president. Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that, Truman declared in accepting the nomination. The Republicans nominated New York State Governor Thomas Dewey. Dewey was a wise and courageous man. He was also very serious. Truman campaigned by telling the voters that Dewey did not understand the needs of the average American. He called Dewey a candidate of rich people. One day, Dewey got angry at a railroad engineer because his campaign train was late for a speech. Truman said this proved that Dewey did not understand the problems of railroad engineers and other working Americans. He tried to make the election a choice between hard-working Democrats and rich Republicans. Two other men also were candidates for the presidency. Both were from newly created parties. One was Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. He was a candidate of the States' Rights Democratic Party, also known as the Dixiecrat Party. Most of his supporters were white people from the southeastern part of the country. They opposed giving full rights to black people. The other candidate was Henry Wallace of the Progressive Party. His supporters believed that Truman had turned away from the progressive ideas of Franklin Roosevelt. Both Thurmond and Wallace had broken away from the Democratic Party. Most political experts believed these two candidates would take votes away from President Truman. They believed the Republican Dewey would surely win the election. President Truman did not have strong public support. But Harry Truman was a fighter. He did not believe the election was lost. He took his campaign to the American people.
On election day, the president, the Congress, the governor, the mayor, all cease as the government. You are the government, because then you decide what sort of a government you want. And when you do like you did in 1946, when two-thirds of you stayed home, you get just what you deserve. You got that good-for-nothing 80th Congress.
He said he had always campaigned by going around, meeting, and talking to people. Running for president was no different, he said. He just got on a train and started across the country to tell people what was going on. He wanted to talk to them face to face. When you stand there in front of them and talk to them, he said, the people can tell whether you are telling them the facts or not.
If you give the Republicans complete control of this government, you might just as well turn it over to the special interests, and we'll start on a boom and bust cycle and try to go through just what we did in the 20s and end up with a crash, which in the long run will do nobody any good but the communists.
Truman campaigned with great energy. He made hundreds of speeches as his train crossed the country. It became known as the Whistle Stop Campaign because it stopped at some of the smallest towns and villages in the country. Truman gave speeches from the back of his campaign train, the Ferdinand Magellan. He spoke to farmers in Iowa. He visited a children's home in Texas. And he discussed issues with small groups of people who came to visit his train when it stopped in rural areas of Montana and Idaho. Dewey and the Republicans laughed at Truman's campaign. They said it showed that Truman needed votes so badly that he had to spend his time looking for them in small villages. Truman said the criticism proved that Republicans did not care for the average American. Dewey also campaigned across the country by train, but he showed little of the fire and emotion in his speeches that made Truman's campaign so exciting. Dewey's speeches were safe. One reporter wrote that Dewey was acting like a man who had already been elected and was only passing time waiting to take office. Dewey had good reasons to feel so sure of being elected. Almost every political expert in the country said Truman had no chance of winning. The Wall Street Journal, for example, printed a story about what Dewey would do in the White House after the election. And the New York Times said that Dewey would win the election by a large majority. Truman refused to accept those views. Instead, he spoke with more and more emotion against Dewey. Most Americans still believed that Truman would lose, but they liked his courage in fighting until the end. One supporter shouted, "Give 'em hell, Harry," them being the Republicans. Soon, supporters across the country were shouting, "Give 'em hell, Harry." Truman made special appeals to working people, Jews, blacks, Catholics, and other traditional supporters of the Democratic Party. In his final radio speech before the election, he promised to work for peace and a government that would help all people. Then he went to his home in the state of Missouri to wait with the rest of the country for the election results. Republicans across the country greeted Election Day happily. They were sure that this was the day that the people would choose to send a Republican back to the White House after 16 years. Some of the early voting results from the northeastern states showed Truman winning. But few Republicans worried. They were sure Dewey would be the winner when all the votes were counted. The Chicago Tribune was also sure who the next president would be, declaring in a huge headline, "Dewey defeats Truman." But the newspaper was wrong. Everyone was wrong. Everyone, that is, except Harry Truman and the Americans who gave him their votes. Truman went to bed on election night before all the votes were counted. He told his assistant that he would win. He awoke early the next morning to learn that he was right. Not only did he defeat Dewey, as he thought he would, but he won by a good number of votes. And he helped many Democratic congressional candidates win as well. The Democrats captured both houses of Congress. After the results were announced, as heard in this old recording, Truman showed his sense of humor by joking about the predictions of his defeat.
I had on the National Broadcasting Company. Kelton Barn was saying, "Well, the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote. We have yet to hear from the president." Very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
Harry Truman would make many difficult decisions as America moved into the second half of the 20th century. Truman would send American troops to help the United Nations defend South Korea against aggression from the North. He would join other Western leaders in establishing a new alliance, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They established NATO to provide for the joint defense of Europe and North America. Truman and later presidents would make decisions to send large amounts of economic and military aid to countries around the world. Many of these decisions were necessary because of America's new responsibilities after World War II as leader of the Western world. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.